It's like repetition, 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 repetition. Like, there's no shortcut to success. Getting back to John Wood, I remember him saying in an interview one time that there are lots of people, talent-wise, who are watching from shore, you know, or who didn't make it to the final or whatever, but they're, you know, they're the most talented, but they don't have that drive, that the desire, the focus, the discipline that's required to make it all happen. And that other people, you know, might be marginally less talented, but they have those other features or traits or abilities that help them ultimately be the best.
Welcome to the Evolution of Leaders podcast. My name is Darwin Lee, and I am a coach and speaker. I'm the founder of the Evolution of Leaders. On this podcast, I'm interested in exploring the traits, habits, or behaviors that set apart elite performers through their stories and in their own words. My guest today is Larry Kane, two top 10 finishes at the Barcelona Olympics in 1992, fourth in Seoul in 1988, although one of his competitors was later caught doping, so he actually deserved to be on the podium. But then in 1984 at the LA Olympics, gold and silver medalist. He's in the Canada Sports Hall of Fame. He's a national team coach for Adam Van Cuverden and Mark Oldershaw, founder and head coach of Paddle Monster. Larry really embodies dreaming big, how he wrote future world Olympic champion on his homework when he handed it in. The interesting thing about him is, how does someone who's at the back of the pack in his training group end up as the Olympic champion? And watch about how he talks about visualization. Today, there's a lot of material written about that, but amazingly, Larry has this innate ability of doing it on his own before he's ever heard of the concept. Just really amazing. I hope you enjoy this interview. Larry, so nice to have you on the show.
Pleasure to be with you, Darwin.
So Larry, as we move forward, I think we'd love to hear kind of in your own words how you might describe your athletic career.
It's been a lot of fun. I guess I'd say it's still going, but at a different level, obviously. I started paddling when I was 11 years old with some neighborhood friends. It was just something that our mothers got us into instead of that year baseball and soccer. And it was something I really enjoyed. One of the biggest things about it at first was that I couldn't stay in a C1, a sprint racing canoe.
Yeah.
And so I was really motivated to just be able to balance in it and let alone, you know, paddle it. And I think, you know, for the first, that would have been 1974, for the first couple of summers, I just, you know, kind of played around, and I wanted to be better than my friends. That was my goal, but I had no goal beyond that. And then in 1976, I saw a local guy by the name of John Wood win a silver medal in Montreal in the 500-meter C1 at the Olympics. And I was watching at home with my parents, and I turned to them and I said, that's what I want to do. And from that day forward, you know, my every waking thought was about paddling. I daydream in school about it. I used to write on test papers and things like that I handed in at school. I'd write Larry Kane, future world and Olympic champion, and hand it in. And
awesome.
I was really fortunate that I had good direction from good coaches. I had great role models around, to older people that I could, whose example I could follow and that I could train with. And I think too, I did a lot of things right intuitively, and that separated me from my peers. And by 1979, I had an opportunity to race at the Junior Worlds. By 1980, I was a top senior, the fastest paddler in the country. And I came fifth at a major international competition in Duisburg, Germany, in 1000 C1. And so I was well on my way. And then in 1981, I won the Junior Worlds over two distances and came fifth at the World Championships as a 18-year-old. And then, you know, I had every year I was in the final of the World Championships, always knocking in the door, only made the podium at the Worlds once, but, you know, hit the podium at the Olympics. As disappointing as it was to miss the podium, say, at the Olympics in Seoul, it was really great to, you know, to at least be called to boat control and be that close, you know. And then later on, when I find out that one of the paddlers was on the list of athletes that these Germans had doped up, in their, you know, their doping program.
Yeah.
That made me feel better about it. You know, one of the guys from Bulgaria, you know, he rode a wash for part of the race, which you're not supposed to do, but people often got away with. I didn't stand on the podium, but I was in the hunt and it was the best I could have done that day. So, you know, I've learned to hold my head high about that. And after I got out of sprint canoe racing, I retired from the national team in 1996 after I didn't make the Olympics. And you probably heard that story when you talked to Gavin. The long and short of it is that I thought I had a good chance to get to the Olympics for my last time in 96 in Atlanta and race 1,000 meter C1. Yeah. And things had been going great in training and I had a decent race at the selections, but I got beat by a guy who I think had the best race of his career up to that point. And a guy from my own club, a training partner, Gavin Maxwell. So he got the entry and I got a handshake and that was it. I retired after that and I got into Dragon Boat and raced all around the world with some really, you know, good flat water paddlers that we all got. You know, that's probably my favorite form of paddling, actually, even more so than C1, because you can do it anywhere in any condition.
So going back, when you're only the future Olympic champion, Olympic and world champion,
right?
You'd mentioned you had a good interview on the Paddle Pod, and you mentioned that when you first started out, you were kind of towards the back of the pack.
Mm-hmm.
And then you really had to work and move forward. I was wondering whether, and clearly you have a lot of talent, but maybe you didn't have as much, you know, whatever that native talent was compared to some other people, but there's something that you did that allowed you to shine and to improve very quickly to the point where you became, you know, fastest in the nation and Olympic champion.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, getting back to John Wood, I remember him saying in an interview one time that there are lots of people, talent-wise, who, you know, are watching from shore, you know, or who didn't make it to the final or whatever, but they're, you know, they're the most talented, but they don't have that drive, that the desire, the focus, the discipline that's required to make it all happen. And that other people, you know, might be marginally less talented, but they have those other features or traits or abilities that help them ultimately be the best. And, you know, I think if you, no matter what endeavor that you're in, no matter what your pursuit is, if you're a person that's relying solely on your talents, you're ultimately going to end up disappointed and fall short of your expectations. It's not so simple to be good in anything. You need to be, you know, a real student of what you do, and you need to be very serious about what you do. And that doesn't mean that you can't have fun, but the people who do it really well get a lot of fun and enjoyment out of being a student of the game, out of being serious about it. And, you know, like I said earlier, when I was a kid, I think I did a lot of things right intuitively, you know, like I can remember in terms of learning technique in an age that predated YouTube and videos and, you know, downloading video of somebody and then watching it. All we ever had was still photos, but fortunately, with John Wood being the you know, the Olympic silver medalist and a local guy, there was lots of pictures in newspapers and magazines and stuff at that time, especially with the Olympics in Canada in 76. And so I clipped out every photo I could ever find, and I used to array them on the ground, you know, and group them by different stages of the stroke, like the catch, the main pulling part, the exit, the recovery. And I would sit in front of my parents' full-length mirror in the paddling, you know, high kneel position, C1 position, with a broom. And I would get into those paddling positions that I saw John in the photos. And I would look at my, my positioning in the mirror, and then I'd look at the positioning that he was in his photos, and I'd try to make them exactly the same. And I believe what that did, and I use this as a coaching method now, for people, I believe what it does is it, you know, when you're trying to learn a technique, especially on a an environment like being on the water, which is very dynamic because you're worrying so much about your balance and the substance that you're leaning onto for support and to propel yourself through isn't solid. It's very challenging to get into the appropriate or the ideal condition positions. And but if you can get to those positions and put your body in those positions when you feel stable on land, then when you do get in your boat or on your paddleboard, your body knows the positions it's looking for, and it's easier to find them and hit all of the different positions at different points in the stroke and end up consolidating, a good movement pattern than it is if you just don't think about things like that and you just hop in the boat and push off the dock and then try to find it. You know, it's like visualization. Like everyone talks about visualization being critical to success and certainly for athletes, but it's like a very physical form of visualization where you're actually not just, lying down and visualizing what you're trying to do, but you're actually putting your body in the proper positions. And no one told me to do that. That was something I just did on my own. But I think it really helped separate me from my peers. And so, once I finally got my balance in the canoe and I established a comfort level, then all of a sudden my improvement became very rapid because of these other things I was doing. You know, and again, that was just something that I did. And then there's other things too. Like I've always believed that if you want to be successful in something that you should have a no stones left unturned approach to it, right? There's always some little things that you must be able to do that make a difference, you know, and maybe one little thing doesn't make much of a difference, but if you do half a dozen or a dozen little things, they can add up to making a substantial difference. You know, so the key is then, to really ask yourself, well, what are the little things I can do to make a difference? Because everybody who's pursuing the same objective, like an Olympic medal or a seat in the Canadian Dragon Boat team or whatever, everyone is doing the big things, right? They all know what the big things you have to do are. So everyone's doing them. But it's like, what little things can you do that make a difference? And if you do enough of those little things, that it can make, rather than making a small difference, it can end up making a significant difference. And so, if you want to be successful at something, you have to, like I said, be a student of it and try to find these ways that you can be better. And and recognize that little things can, in the end, make a significant difference.
Are you a believer that the small disciplines lead to the larger disciplines? It sounds like that's what you're saying.
I used to look at everything when I was on my way up in canoe, like between, sort of realizing like my first junior worlds in 79 through till the Olympics in 84 for that 5-year period, I would say I was really good at viewing everything I did. Like everything I did as some type of opportunity cost scenario. So if my friend said, hey, come on out with us Friday night, we're going to do, something cool. It'd be really fun. I think it over and think, okay, like I want to go, but like, what's going to be the effect on my Saturday morning performance? Saturday morning was always time controls and I wanted to do, well, and I wanted to do a fast time.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's going to be the impact on my Saturday morning time control if I go out on Friday night? And occasionally I'd go out, but more often than not, what I would do is I'd find a way to decline because, for me, I always knew I was going to have more fun and have more satisfaction by performing well in the time control on Saturday morning than I was ever going to have going out and just doing what teenagers do with my friends on Friday night, So I would always ask myself these, the to sort of weigh the pros and cons of doing things like that. So in that sense, I was very disciplined. And I think having that kind of awareness, that global awareness that everything you do to some degree affects where you want to go and whether you're going to get there. That mindfulness of that that concept, I think, helped me. Again, it helped separate me from my peers at an early age. I really, once I started to get that separation and started to actually be competitive with adults while I was 16, 17,
yep.
and then started to beat the adults by the time I was 18 and be the best in the country and making the finals at the world championships against men, that process happened really quickly once I, you know, got on that trajectory. I just kept getting better and better and better, faster and faster. And I think the trick was to sort of get on that trajectory. And in my time paddling, you know, at the canoe club, I've seen one other person sort of do that. And it was Vancouverden. And, you know, and he's won 4 Olympic medals, you know. And then he channeled everything he did as an athlete, everything he learned as an athlete, and the hard work he put in as an athlete, he channeled that into being, to running for public office.
Yeah.
And he defeated Lisa Raitt, who was deputy PM and has a seat in parliament, you know. These skills are transferable. And in many ways, like, they're innate. Because we used to say about Adam, you know, like, shortly after he turned up at the canoe club, like, whoa, this kid's like, he's got it together. He's going to go somewhere, you know? And he probably wasn't the most talented guy physically, but geez, no one worked harder. And,
wow.
You know, so I do think that, and we're 20 years apart.
Yeah.
You know? And so, you know, maybe once every 20 years in our country, in that sport, you see somebody doing something special like that. And because it's not, you know, I taught high school for 18 years, and most kids don't think that way. You know, they're kids have goals, but they're, you know, I got my goal, but I'm not going to let my goal, I'm not going to think about my goal on Friday night. I'm going out, you know?
Yeah.
And, but people, there's having a goal and then there's having a goal, you know? And, those people who have that extra gear to focus on something tend to go on and do great things.
It's interesting that you're mentioning Adam's story, and you've been a mentor to a number of people, as you yourself have been mentored. You've talked about John Wood. Mm-hmm. And so I'd like to play a clip. I had a great talk, great talk with Gavin Maxwell, and I'll play it, and then we can get your thoughts for you know, which, what your thoughts are on it.
Sure.
I think I didn't make the final. I was like one of the last guys in the semifinal. And I remember sitting on the dock, still finishing, like just finished my race, like sitting on the dock with my legs still in my canoe, this like contemplating life. And I remember, like it was yesterday, that I decided, like, either I'm going to quit or I'm going to get better, because this is no fun. Spending all this time training and still not doing well. And so the interesting thing is that my belief was that I was training hard. And when I had that experience, I realized, okay, obviously I'm not doing something right. And then I started actually looking at what guys like Larry Kane and other guys at our club were doing. And I wasn't doing what they were doing. So my idea of hard work and what was actually hard work were not the same. You know, so I had this sort of false ceiling of hard work.
When you hear that, and he flips a switch, and at that point, that was kind of the point at which he made the decision, as you did, and it sounds like as Adam did, and he started to really improve, and at one point he sets the record, and you know, a lot of other awesome things. And so, how do you view the role of a coach or a good mentor? What does a good mentor or a good coach pass on to another person?
The coach and the athlete work so closely together that sometimes, you know, the it's almost like, you know, being a teacher and being a coach of kids, you find out, you get a lot of parents coming up to you and saying, oh man, like, I'm so glad you told my kid that, you know, I've been trying to tell them that forever and they don't listen, but you tell them and they believe it, you know? And I think sometimes there's an element of that too with a coach. And so the art of being a good coach is to be able to not have that happen, that you can actually pull somebody aside and have a chat with them, and or lead by example, you know? But it's hard often to lead by example when you, a coach may not be training anymore, you know? So that's why it's good to have somebody who is still training or who is still paddling or can still walk the walk to be the mentor, you know? But what, you know, what do good mentors do? Well, they, you know, I think they lead by example. Like, they don't have to do a lot of, you know, like loud talking. It's like they give you a few words and they say, you, basically the message that you want to convey to somebody is precisely what Gavin said, is that, you know, kids always think they're working hard. And, you know, as the coach or the teacher, I'm looking at them and I'm thinking, they're not working hard enough, you know? And I mean, that's just the universal reality. And so it's being able to reach the person that you're mentoring and let them see, help them realize, come to the realization that they can do so much more than they're currently doing. And that can be, they can set their goals a lot higher than they're currently setting them, or it can be, they can just work a lot harder than they're currently working. They can have higher standards for themselves than they currently have. They can, you know, they can have a lower tolerance for mediocrity than they currently have. They can have better focus than they currently have. They can start asking themselves about what are the little things, like, you know, here's my goal. My goal is to be, you know, the best in my chosen sport. But, you know, there are a whole bunch of things that you do in your life outside of training for your chosen sport that can have an effect on your preparation for success in your chosen sport. And I think too often people keep things in silos, like, well, this is my training silo. This is my friend's side, my social life silo. This is my school or work silo. And they don't, you know, everything just kind of runs in parallel. But the fact of the matter is these things all interact with each other. And, you know, what's happening at school or work or what's happening in social life often impacts what's happening, you know, in sport training or competition. And it's coming to the realization that you really have to, if you really want to be good at something, you know, if it's sport, you got to elevate the sport silo and the focus you're putting on into that above the other things, you know, at least most of the time. And you know, if it's somebody who's pursuing like a really high level education, then they have to obviously focus on their education and the other, you know, like the fun games, you know, there's less time for that, right? Like it's having this consciousness I think the best thing you can convey as a mentor is that nothing worth accomplishing is easy. But you and I both know that in society nowadays, people expect things to happen, you know, like they do a little bit of work. And I'd be teaching in the gym at work, at school, and, you know, we'd be teaching volleyball and I'd be, you know, asking kids to serve. And I said, okay, you know, we spend a lot of time working on the mechanics of a serve, you know, against the wall or whatever, with partners, whatever. And that's okay, you know, like to go start banging out some serves. And a kid would, you know, get 10 over the net and they'd sit down or they'd start talking. And I'd come by and I was like, what's going on? Well, I can do it. I've done it. And I said, like, well, are you an expert now? You've served, you know, 10 good serves. Like, people don't have the understanding that it's like repetition, 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 repetition. Like, there's no shortcut to success. And if as a mentor, you can convey that, but you can do it in such a way that doesn't completely intimidate them from what they're involved in or doesn't deflate them and take the fun out of it for them. But if you can, you know, if you can instill them with the belief that they can do it, but that they have to step up their game, then I think that's what it's all about. And Gavin clearly, you know, made that connection on his own, sitting in the dock that day.
Yeah.
And, but then, you know, when he started to come out and train with us, then he watched and he learned and he got into it and he tried to be, you know, like he it might have taken him, you know, a little bit of time to gain some confidence, but, you know, within a relatively short period of time, like he's competitive and he's kicking people's butts in training and, you know, and he's on his way. Right. But the things he accomplished being an Olympian would never have happened if he didn't have that come to that realization that he's got to do more than he'd been doing.
He made a decision. Yeah. And it's amazing the effect on his career. And, mm-hmm. and in your case, going forward, you know, your drive and your work ethic led you to the 1984 Olympics. And the interesting thing about, there's many interesting things, and I'd like to dive in a little bit because there's a lot of lessons just kind of encapsulated, I feel, in that part of your life. You were not considered a favorite. And in the end, you got the gold medal. You upset one of the favorites and the reigning world champion by over a second, by a margin. And so going through that whole experience, the first thing that I found fascinating was the way in you weren't just in the warm-up for the final was a little bit different and really, you know, set the stage for everything else. But to me, it was a really good statement about preparation, hard work, and just understanding kind of the environment. Can you take us through that?
Yeah. I mean, well, first of all, I'd say that, you know, the favorite business was like Castica Lara, who was the world champion in 1983. He had a good lane when we at the Worlds in 83 in Tampere, Finland. It was really windy. It was a big, strong headwind. And he was in lane, I had lane 9 for both finals, which was the worst lane.
Yeah.
And he had lane 1 when he won his 500 meter gold medal at the Worlds. And, you know, anyone on the outside of the course didn't have a chance. And so I was, you know, just by lane had the least chance. So, you know, what I did is for years, I took those results with a grain of salt. Like we are a sport that's subject to the conditions. And I know I said to try to love the conditions, but sometimes no matter how much you try to be optimistic about them and try to, you know, sort of, you know, don't let them, you know, I'm not going to let the conditions bother me, but like, you know, like
there's a factor.
There's no way that it's like, you just can't do it at that level. Like you can't overcome that kind of disadvantage. So what I did for a year was I didn't dwell on the fact that I came seventh at those world championships. And I knew that if I did everything I possibly could, that I could race well and have a chance to compete for a medal in LA. And throughout World Cups that spring in 84, I raced well. So, you know, I knew when I got to LA that I had a chance to win as good as anybody. And, but what I wanted to do is I wanted to ensure that my focus was only like, there's so at any time you're racing a big competition, you know, it's easy to start thinking about, you know, the outcome before you've done the race. You know, like everyone wants to win an Olympic gold medal. The opportunity is right in front of you, and it's easy to get distracted by that, you know, by that possibility. And I didn't want to even consider that. I didn't want to get ahead of myself. And so what I did was I went out and I got my training partner, Pete Koshinow from Oakville. And he was the spare on our team, so he didn't have a race. And I got him to come out and do my warm-up with me. And we did three really hard minute pieces all out, like all out. And we took big rest. Like it was a long warm-up, and we took like a 4-minute rest. And I knew from training, we used to do a workout called, we call 10 times 1 minute all out with 4-minute rest. And we would do it over a 250 meter course. We go back and forth, back and forth, back and forth over the 250 meter course. And I knew that the fourth one was always my best one. And then, you know, I'd be good out of the gate, but I get faster, 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 and then be fastest for 4 or 5. And then I'd start to get, you know, filled up with, you know, lactate a bit. And I'd start to struggle and fight and scratch and claw. And I could still,
right.
Was really good if you could go more than 250 meters. in the minute for all 10. And I could do that. But I knew that my fourth, fifth were my best ones. And so what I did was I decided to try something different in warm-up, where I was going to go out and I was going to do three of those all out, put myself in the same position as I would be back home on the river doing that workout, which was the one that was the most intense workout we did. And I always got so zoned in on the river of just, you know, looking down the, you know, the course and trying to, you know, all that mattered was like basically that stretch of water between me and the, you know, the finish line, which was in that case, 250 meters downriver. And so I did that as my warm up. And when I got to the starting blocks, it was just basically all that mattered was I was looking down the course 500 meters, you know, up, seeing all the buoys in my lane. And I just took a quick glance to my left, a quick glance to my right. I was in lane seven. So I saw six guys to my left and two to my right. And I knew that, you know, I could beat all of them. I also knew that there's guys that could beat me, but like, that's the only consideration of my opponents that I had. And then I just looked back down my lane and I just thought like, you know, I'm on my river. Like I'm just, it's, you know, this is my time to, you know, crank out, you know, my best one, just like I do at home. And, so that level of focus, that level of intensity, was the perfect amount to pull into the starting blocks for. And I was still, I hadn't taken a big rest from the third one that we did in warm up to the start. You know, it was probably only about 6 or 7 minutes rest. And, because I remember saying, you know, Pete saying, okay, good luck, man, you're ready. And I say, okay, man, yep, I'll see you at the finish, you know, and then doing one or two little tiny circles and then going into the starting block. So I was still like, you know, really like really intensely focused. And then,
oh, man,
bang, you know, the race started. And I felt, you know, if I look at the video now, I didn't have the best start. Like the first 75 meters or so, I'm behind a little bit, but it was the gear after that from 75 to 150, I just like, you know, just like exploded and then just kept going. And I was so focused, you know, like that I got to the point where around 250, halfway in, things started to get quiet because I got the impression that I was like, there was nobody around me.
Yeah.
And I remember it was very quiet. And then I could hear that I just heard as I went through the 250, I heard like a roar. And it was, you know, of the crowd. And later on watching races, they would announce what was happening. It's, oh, at the 250, it's so-and-so, you know? So that was like people, you know, I just heard this kind of like at the 250. And I just kept going. Like I wasn't thinking, my mind didn't wander at all. I was just, you know, I was aware of things, but a lot of the things I was aware of, I didn't realize I was aware of them until after I was running it through my head, you know? And it wasn't like I ever stopped focusing just on the finish line and the next stroke. You know, it was one of the best races I've ever had for being like entirely focused on the paddling. And it was just, you know, it was the last 100 meters. I was in front enough that I took it off just a little bit off just because it was like, you know, I remember thinking, don't mess it up. Like, just, you know, you got this. Like I actually have this. Don't mess it up. Like, it was, you know, I just was a little bit more, instead of, like, frantically trying to get every last, like, you know, like, ounce of energy out of my body to cross the finish line with about 100 meters left, it was like, you know, control it and don't let it go. And it was a pretty special feeling.
Amazing. Yeah. And thank you so much for sharing that. And as I researched this a little bit, here are the results. And can you see that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And so the interesting thing is, so for the first, it's 500 meter race. And so for the first 250, you have the fastest 250 at 56 mm-hmm. and change.
Yeah.
And so the interesting thing to me, which I'll ask you about here is, for the second 250, you're the third fastest. And so yep. In second place is Jacobsen or Jakobsen. I apologize. Yep. I might be mispronouncing that, but
yep.
His second 250 is he shaves like a 4/10 off, a little bit quicker. And so what I was wondering is, now you've said you're in the zone, but you know, for those of us who are you know, in all kinds of situations where we might be distracted, did you pay attention? Did you know he was gaining on you, or did that?
No, I mean, if you look at the video, I'm like well in front, and
yeah,
like I said, I got, you know, when I went through the 250, I was I didn't even realize until you showed me that I didn't, that I was the third fastest in the second 250. Again, you know, like I got out in front, everything just got quiet. And in a C1 race, especially at that time when we were in the old boats, where they're a little bit wider than the new boats, and every stroke you took, you know, you kind of made contact with your paddle against the gunwale of the boat to steer.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so if you heard a 9-boat canoe race coming at you, you'd hear clunk, 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 clunk of people sort of steering a little bit. And when you're in the race, you know, that's just part of the background noise that you hear when you're paddling in a race. And as I got my nose further in front, I stopped hearing that. Like it got really quiet. And that's a very good thing. And I would think that looking at those splits, I don't know whether I could have been the fastest in the second half or not, because I did go up pretty hard. But I think that I could have been like at least half a second faster than that split shows, because of what I did in the last, or didn't do in the last 100 meters. You know, like I consciously took it down, like I took it down probably a notch, but you know, when I should have been taking it up a notch, if that makes any sense, right?
Yeah.
Because I just didn't want to, like, why do a big finish and have something, you know, miss a stroke, panic, you know, catch my paddle in the water or something like that. Just all I tried to do is just keep the rhythm, but I took some of the power off my stroke and just tried to keep the rhythm and just, you know, kind of like, make sure that, just control it, you know, rather than try to keep pushing. And cause, you know, not that I've ever seen it happen, but like the worst thing that could have happened was, you know, like you had it and you fell in or something, you know, it'd be like, Brian Stemmel at Nagano in the men's downhill.
Yeah. Yeah.
I remember watching that race and you know, after what he went through in his career and the major crash at the Honeycomb, and he almost dies in it, and he has to take at least a year to put his body back together. And then here he is in Nagano in the men's downhill, and he's the first two splits up the top of the hill. He's the first split, he's ahead. The second split, he's ahead by more. And he's on the flats at the, you know, like he's literally like 10 seconds away from the finish, and he's in the flats where you're just in your tuck and just gliding it out. The technical stuff's over, and he catches an edge, and and he had the gold medal. And you know, like I cried when I watched that, like I actually, you know, shed a tear. And, you know, like that happened many years after my race in LA, but that was the kind of thing that I was trying to avoid, you know? And, so I just kind of kept the rhythm, but didn't, you know, pull as hard. So I could have maybe been faster, but, I had no idea that anyone was, my head was still in my boat.
That's what I get. And that's incredible because it means that even had Jakobsen been closer, we're fairly certain the champ is still a champ. So I wanted to ask you something about, you know, from the world of sports psychology and mental toughness. When, you know, you're in a dogfight and it's, you know, maybe 50 meters, you know, maybe 25 from the finish, and your body's on fire and you felt it many, many times. You know, your lungs are on fire, your legs are singeing. How do you find it in you to dig deep? Do you have is there a way you get through kind of those tough, strenuous moments?
You know, what I try to do is prevent my stroke from, and the canoe or the board from bogging down. So, you know, you've got a dragon boat background, an outrigger background. So, you know that, you know, when you can get the boat especially a dragon boat, like up on top of the water, it's, you know, it's humming along. Outrigger, the same thing. You know, if you can have it up on top, it's kind of skipping across the surface of the water. It's relatively easy, you know? I mean, it's not easy. It's not like you're out for just a cruise. You're working really hard to keep it there, but it's on your muscles, it's a relatively easy load because you're being dynamic, right? It's just like a boom, like a dynamic. You're on top of your stroke and the boat is kind of like, you know, it's up, sitting up in the water. There's less resistance. There's less wetted surface. So it's kind of like, you know, skipping across the surface.
Yeah.
Like a stone, you know, that you throw at the beach. But once you start to get tired and once your stroke gets less dynamic in the water, and it starts to lose a little speed, it starts to sink in the water a little bit more. And that's a deadly thing to have occur when you're getting tired, because you're never going to get it back up again. So the key is to try to keep it up and not let it sink down. Because once it sinks down and it's late in a race and you're tired, it's not going to come back up. And what happens once it sinks down, you tend to go slower and slower and slower because your muscles are screaming. You know, they're so tired. And you all of a sudden now those muscles are facing increased resistance the lower the boat starts sitting in or the board starts sitting in the water. So my big thing has always been to try to kind of preempt that and to just kind of keep it as dynamic as I can and keep it skipping, you know, sitting as high on top of the water as I can, skipping across the surface as I can. And so, you know, late in a race like that, all I'm trying to do is find a way to keep it doing that. And it's not always pretty, you know, because ultimately it's about getting enough strokes in to keep it up. Like if your stroke rate slows down, your boat's going to drop. And obviously you'd like them to be really good strokes too, but the good strokes sometimes are harder to do at that point. You know, it's like the first 450 meters of a 500 meter race can be pretty. And the last 50 is just survival. Same thing, you know, the last 100 meters of a 1,000 meter race is like survival. And so I'm just trying to do whatever I can to survive at that point. But the easiest way to survive well, to still go fast, is to just keep the board or the boat on top of the water. So I'm constantly just trying to find a way to move my body fast enough and to get enough of my paddle to keep my boat on top of the water. And, you know, there's no real self-talk that goes on. It's desire and instinct, you know, and you've done it so many times that I do believe that practicing finishing pieces in training strong helps develop the mindset to do it in a race. So, you know, like, so one of the things I still try to do it now is if I'm doing a piece in a workout, I'll try to make sure that the last 30 seconds of the piece, without taking anything off, say it's a 5-minute piece, you know, without taking anything off in the first 4.5 minutes, the last 30 seconds I try to like raise it up a little bit, you know, not a lot, but just enough that it's like, I'm doing here, you know, I'm making my body just, you know, raise the tempo, the power, the rate, the dynamicness of the stroke. I'm trying to like increase all those things just marginally in the last say 30 seconds of the piece, because it's habit forming, as opposed to, and you'll see people train this way where they, you know, they go out hard, they get ahead, they'll, you know, or they get tired, they'll slow down a little bit at the end of a piece, you know, and that's habit forming too, in a bad way.
You have some great pictures on your various social media, which you really embraced, which is great. And this is one with your training partners, and man, great picture.
Yeah.
And yeah. You see, you're working hard, and you've really embraced stand up paddling.
Mm-hmm.
And this is you.
That's in Hawaii.
Yeah.
Connor Baxter and Ryan Funk. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Harbor, yeah.
And then there's this one, which is not in Hawaii.
No, that's definitely not in Hawaii. That's off the what refinery is that? I don't even know what refinery that is. No, a St. Lawrence Cement Pier in Clarkson, Ontario.
It's clear you're really committed to the sport, which is great, and you've been good for the sport. And so, tell us a little bit about Paddle Monster and some of the things you're doing with stand up paddling.
Well, I got involved in stand up paddling in 2010, and found it immediately that it was a lot like canoe, a lot like C1, but standing up. And so I became really good on the right side, but it was a real work in progress for many years on the left because I'd only ever paddled right in C1. Anyway, long story short is, you know, I took the job coaching the national canoe team in 2014. It was supposed to last through to the Olympics in 2016. And that contract ended up running out in April 2016, before the Olympics. And fortunately, I knew in September 2015 that was going to happen. So I had some time to prepare myself for, you know, what might come after. You know, like, I quit my teaching job to take the national team coaching job. So I didn't have a teaching job to return to. And so, certainly one of my options could have been to go back to teaching, but I really didn't want to after having enjoyed the freedom of being, not having to go to a traditional job every day. So I wanted to start a business in stand-up paddling because I recognized that it was a really rapidly growing water sport. It was very much like canoe. Although I wasn't didn't have an ocean background, more and more and more people who were getting involved in stand-up paddling didn't come from, you know, an ocean environment, and they needed guidance. They needed help. They didn't know, you know, they didn't have a lot of knowledge about paddling, and that, so there was a demand for somebody who could provide them with that knowledge. And I figured, why not, you know, why shouldn't that be me? And I wanted to set up something where we took the traditional business model, which was, you know, get a bunch of boards and a trailer to tow them around on, do lessons and coach in your local area. And the problem with that business model, of course, is that you have a big outlay at the beginning. You're spending a lot of money at the beginning to equip yourself. You have only local reach. And in Canada, at least in this part of the world, you're seasonal. And I didn't think any of those things made that a particularly good business model, one that was geared for success. So I wanted to kind of flip that, and I wanted to try to set something up that would have unlimited reach, that wasn't confined to any particular season, and that had basically zero overhead. And the only, venue for you to set up something like that is the internet. And so I knew it had to be some kind of internet-based coaching where I was sharing my knowledge. And long story short, I hooked up with John Bosang from Wilmington, North Carolina, who had expressed interest in building some type of online coaching site in the past, and who was running a webpage for ocean paddling called Distress Mullet. Not a bad haircut, but like a bait fish, you know, as a mullet. And so we started this company called Paddle Monster. And his background is, he paddles and he surfs and he's an ocean athlete, but his background is marketing and tech to a lesser extent. And mine was obviously coaching, with not any clue on how to market myself or, really tech phobic sort of. And so it was a good match. We'd known each other for quite a while. We had this good trust in each other. And we started Paddle Monster, and we promoted it for about 2 months before we launched in the middle of May 2016. And within the first hour, we had 80 subscribers looking for online coaching. And so we've been going since then, and John rolled the Distress Mullet page into into Paddle Monster, and that's really helped things because we have, I think, a really good website. It's really content heavy. There's like a ton of stuff that goes up there all the time. Instructional stuff, stuff about gear. There's classifieds for equipment sales. We just recently started a virtual paddle league race series or time trial series. We've got a bunch of different events running right now. 500 meters, 1,000 meters, 2K and 5K. And they run all year, so you can continue to, as you do personal best, you know, post a new time to the leaderboard. So that's all done through the site. Got a really extensive YouTube channel with lots of instructional videos on. And then, of course, we have our app, which is for subscribers only, where they do all their communication with our coaches. That's myself, Travis Grant, who's a Molokai to Oahu champion in both stand-up paddleboard and outrigger, one-man outrigger. And Seychelle Webster, who's the APP world champion in women's paddleboard last year. We've got Chris Chapman, who's the former strength coach for Kinukai Canada and coached in two Olympic cycles. He's also worked with a bunch of other Canadian Olympic medalists in a variety of other sports. So he's our strength coach. And we've got Victoria Burgess, who from Florida, who's a PhD and a sport nutritionist and who paddles and surfs. And so she's one of our coaches as well. So we've got this great coaching staff, and everyone's providing content and coaching groups. So we're doing, you know, there's other people who are doing the same type of coaching that we are. I think we were first to market, but there's other people who are doing the same thing. And they keep us honest, but, you know, we, still currently, I think, are the, you know, the leaders in this field, and we're constantly trying to find ways to innovate and make things even more amazing for the people who subscribe. And so we've really expanded our reach this year. That the pandemic's been actually really good for us, because we've got we've produced a lot more content. You know, I was locked down for a couple of weeks. I didn't paddle. And that was traumatic, but I realized that in that time I did a lot of stuff that, you know, created a lot of content for the app. And and I realized what it was like for people who were locked down for a lot longer than I was, and they just needed stuff that they could do that where they could continue to be engaged, and they could continue to feel like they're doing something to help them prepare for the day when they could get back in the water. And so that was really a good motivation to produce a lot of good quality content. And then, we started the Virtual Paddle League, which has been, you know, there's a few other virtual races out there, but none of them are ones where the event goes the entire year and you can continue to post times. Like, you know, so I've only posted one 5K time on it. And I had the lead for about probably about 3 hours. And then a kid from a 14-year-old kid from Holland went and beat me by 8 seconds. And I mean, it's legit too. Like, yeah, it's not like he's making it up, because his GPS doesn't lie. And and then, you know, somebody else came along and beat him. So then he went and did an even faster time. And that's really cool, because there's been some movement on the leaderboards. And it's also cool because there's no way that I would have even known about this kid had it not been for this virtual race league.
Your platform you've created.
You know, yeah. Let alone, you know, be you know, in a friendly competition with them. And what we do know is, you know, a lot of people have difficulty with the concept of a virtual race, because it's not a head-to-head race, and it depends on the conditions that you do it in. You know, if you do it in ideal conditions, warm water, salt water, you know, whatever, you're likely going to be faster than the person who did it in really cold water on a windy day or whatever. But, you know, we recognize that when you're doing times, you recognize it, especially in, you know, you mentioned the Canadian garden boat women did a world record. Well, in truth, that's actually what we call a world best time. because we don't really have world records and events where, you know, like they're not in a pool or they're not in a, on a track with the wind less than 3 meters a second, right? But the understanding is that nobody does a world best time unless conditions are favorable. Like they don't do them in headwinds, you know? Right. And so I think everyone just accepts the fact that, you know, if somebody banged off a fast time, A, they're good, and B, they probably had decent conditions. But what it does tell you is that, you know, it doesn't tell you that somebody who's 15 seconds faster than you or 10 seconds faster than you, 5 seconds faster than you on the Virtual Paddle League leaderboard is better than you. What it tells you is that really that they've done a faster time, but that if we were doing head-to-head races, that we would probably see each other on the race course. You know, we probably, like if we were within that range time, that if we were doing a 10K race or a 15K race or a 20K race, that it's pretty certain that we'd see each other on the race course. Maybe we'd be in the same draft train. Maybe we'd, you know, be paddling together for a while. Maybe we'd be paddling, working together, you know, the two of us just the whole way, you know, who knows. But so what's happened is that, you know, people have from all around the world are doing this, and the cool part of it is that they're competing with people that they would never have otherwise had a chance to. And they're using the performance of these other people to spur them to, and motivate them to go faster than they've ever gone before. So it's, you know, it's a really healthy, fun, competitive environment. And I think it will last well beyond it. You know, we started it as a way to fill a void that people would have in a pandemic where there aren't any races, but I'm certain we'll find ways to keep it going into the future, because I think there's real value to it as sort of a fun training tool. And the other cool thing is that, you know, some of the distances we're doing aren't traditional in stand-up paddling, and but we're getting a book of, you know, like of times on what, so people can start to understand what's possible. Like, what is a good time for 500 meters on a stand-up paddleboard? What is a good time for, you know, 1K? You know, I don't know if, have you been to the site? Have you looked at the leaderboard?
Not the leaderboard portion, but it's sounding very stimulating. I could see very motivating.
Just out of curiosity, because you know paddling, you know, like, you know, from having paddled Outrigger and Dragon Boat, what would you say, what would be your guess is the top time for a kilometer, for 1,000 meters, for a person on a paddleboard?
Okay, so and I got to preface by saying I'm not familiar with stand-up paddleboard times, okay. But and so sorry, it's 1 kilometer.
Yeah, well, 1 kilometer. I just take a guess.
Okay, I'll go with 5 minutes.
Wow, you're really good. It's 5:01.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and so we're right on the threshold of two guys have done 5:01. They're right on the threshold of going sub five, which, you know, makes me think of when I was starting to race 1,000 meters in C1. It was a big deal to go sub four, you know? And I got to a point where I could go like 3:52 and I could go under four pretty consistently. But, you know, now with new equipment and obviously the sport progressing another 20 years,
yeah,
people are going like, you know, 3:45, you know, maybe even 43, like, you know, sport continues to evolve. But, you know, we're right at the threshold of somebody going sub five for a kilometer on a paddleboard, which is really quite fast.
It's good that you're involved in a sport that's growing and you're at the forefront in many ways. And moreover, you're creating a platform through which, you know, kind of group improvement can happen.
Yeah. I mean, I feel really good about the fact, like I'm not at the forefront as an athlete. Like I'm, you know, it's a pretty lame sport if you're at the forefront as an athlete at the age of 57. You know, it doesn't say much for the sport, you know, like maybe the only sport in the world I can think of that where that might be the case is like lawn bowling or something. Right. And, not like a real, like a truly athletic sport. On my day in the right conditions, I can be competitive with the very top guys, but more frequently than not, I'm in the next group, which is still amazing.
Yeah.
But where I can be at the forefront as a coach, as a thought leader, as somebody with, you know, decades of paddling experience at a high level that's transferable to stand-up paddling, you know, and as a coach of, I coach some of the pros, and I coach, we like to say the pros and the Joes, you know, like I coach a lot of people who are, you know, adult novices who want to get better.
Yeah. Enjoy the sun, enjoy the water. Yeah, sure.
And we help them achieve it. And it's rewarding. It's fun and rewarding working with them as much as it is with the pros. In many ways more, actually, because these people haven't experienced the joys of, you know, the fun of setting a goal and achieving it in sport. They haven't, you know, this, and particularly paddling. And there's a, you know, like a little bit of work can make a big difference in their performance, which is really gratifying too. So, so I feel privileged to be, have gotten into the stand-up paddling sport, you know, early enough. I think wasn't in at the very beginning, but early enough that, I could occupy one of those, roles as a leader and yet still be, you know, like be an athlete in it too, and be continually striving to improve and learn more and get better. And, a lot of what I do now, you know, trying to improve and trying to learn more, trying to get better, is so that I can then pass that information on to other people. It's not so much for me to race with anymore, because, if I never went in another race again in my life, I'd be able to say it's been good, you know, but, being able to help others from my experience is really important. And so every time I go out and do a workout, it's like professional development, you know, especially when the water's rough, I'm learning things and always thinking. And much like I was as a little kid, when my goal was to be, you know, future world and Olympic champion, I was always thinking, you know, what little things can I do to be better? I find myself thinking now, what little things can I share with somebody to help them be better?
Larry, this has been so awesome. And it's so awesome to see that you're being a mentor to others, as you yourself were mentored by people such as John Wood. So we wish you all the best on your journey with Paddle Monster and all the races and all the coaching and the future and all the people whose lives you're going to touch.
Oh, thanks, Darwin. It's been a lot of fun chatting with you. I really appreciate the concept of what you're doing, and I'm going to find out how I can watch more of your interviews.
Yeah, and we look forward to sharing them with you and with everyone else. So thanks so much.
Excellent. Yeah, cheers. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that interview as much as I had conducting it. Just great insights from the great Larry Kane, really embodying the idea that talent is not enough, as hard work and dedication and discipline. In the days well before the internet, clipped pictures of John Wood, the Olympic medalist, and emulated the images. Really fantastic. And I love this, how he practices visualization before he ever knew what visualization was or what the word was. That's just fantastic stuff. From what I've read, the greats have particular traits and behaviors that they share, and we can learn from them. And that's why I started this podcast, and I wanted to share these ideas with other people. And again, from just superior training on his own and with his training groups and training partners, alters his warm-up to win the gold in LA at 1984, but really has a good reason for doing that and a good reason to think that it will lead to a superior performance. Had good mentors, good coaching, good training partners, and possessed the discipline. And he spoke to us about breaking barriers and the views he shares about talented people, you know, sometimes not being in the final, and just kind of a self-awareness thing kind of within Larry and maybe other people perhaps not sharing that to the same degree. And coaching helps us to recognize and get over some of those barriers. And if you'd like to learn more about coaching, I am a coach and would love to hear from you. I'm at theevolutionofleaders.com. So that's evolutionofleaders.com. If you enjoyed this, please like, subscribe, and share. I
don't charge anything for this. And I do this to share insights from great people around the world and just pay it forward. And if you like, subscribe and share, I would really love that. And I appreciate that so much. Thank you so much for listening and watching.